Welcome to The Mindful Way, a podcast series from Mental Health Ireland. My name is Miffy Hode, one of the team of development officers with Mental Health Ireland, and in this podcast series, I'm talking to people about using mindfulness practices and principles to navigate various life challenges. In this episode, we're looking at chronic pain and illness, and I'm in conversation with Fidelma Farley. Fidelma is a Breathworks mindfulness trainer. She's been teaching mindfulness and compassion to groups and individuals since 2008. More recently, she's been teaching online, primarily the 8-week Breathworks Mindfulness for Health and Mindfulness for Stress courses. As well as training people to teach mindfulness, her particular areas of interest are mindfulness for chronic pain and long-term health conditions, mindful eating, loving kindness, compassion, and mindfulness for the menopause. Fidelma is also a life coach. She is also one of the founding members of Breathworks Ireland and a member of the MTAI, Mindfulness Teachers Association of Ireland. You'll find links to more information about Fidelma, her work, and where you can access her courses in the resources section on our webpage, www.mentalhealthireland.ie/mindfulness. I caught up with Fidelma at her home in the beautiful village of Baltinglass, and we began by exploring the nature of chronic illness and pain. During our conversation, a magpie started chattering in the back garden, so you'll hear him, and I hope his taking issue with the cat that walked through his domain doesn't distract too much from the wonderful wisdom that Fidelma is sharing with us. I want to thank Fidelma for her time and generosity in all she shared in the recording of this episode, and also for inviting me to stay for dinner with her and her family afterwards. I hope you enjoy what's to come, and we'll pick up the conversation from here. We're talking about chronic pain and illness in this episode and managing it using mindfulness practices and techniques. But before we kind of get into that part of it, can we talk a little bit about the nature of chronic pain and illness and living with something that's long term?
Yeah, absolutely. It is different to an acute episode of, you know, breaking your leg or having the flu or whatever. Because there are definite effects, there's a huge impact to living with something that is ongoing, and it has quite a lot of psychological effects to it. You know, definitely has an impact on things like mood and anxiety and self-view and self-confidence, all of those things. And I have my own experience of it, so I might talk from that, if that's okay.
That would be great, if you wouldn't mind.
Just because there are things I kind of have noticed myself about it. So I've had IBS for years, since I was a child, and pretty much ignored it actually for a very long time, which is also a really common thing for people with chronic conditions, is they just barrel through as much as possible. And that was the case for me for years and years and years. I could just about get away with not paying any attention to it because I was young and healthy in other respects. So the effects that it would have were kind of just, they didn't impact massively on my life, except every so often I would have a terrible bout where I just would be in pain and not able to eat very much. But then later I developed diverticulosis, and that's kind of acute episode. So it's like an episode where there's quite a bit of pain, lasting anything from a few days to a week, and then I'm fine.
Okay.
So that just, and that's been ongoing now for the past 6 years, I think. So the effects of that are, so when I actually have an episode, my mood gets quite low. And I think that's really common when you're experiencing pain like that, is just that it just really brings you down. Because it feels a bit overwhelming. Your life suddenly gets completely shrunk to the bed or, you know, the toilet or whatever.
Sure, yeah.
Whatever your kind of little world just shrinks to this. The fact that it has come back is also, oh no, here this is again. You might have thought that you dealt with it or that things had changed. So there's that kind of, oh, depressive sort of, you know, this is here again. Yeah, so definite low mood to that.
Really, it resonate with you on that one, because that idea of it coming back. Because there is this idea that when we get sick, we can be sick for a while, but then we get better. And there is an expectation around us, I think, as well, of are you still sick? Are you, and that not getting better. Or we get complacent then when we're sort of, let us call it between episodes.
Yeah.
And we feel well and all of that. And we nearly forget that we have this long-term condition. And then it's like, bang.
Yeah.
And it's so disheartening or something, and disappointing and frustrating, isn't it? That
absolutely
unpredictability of it. And that, oh God, here we are again kind of feeling.
Yeah, absolutely. And then added to that can be guilt or self-criticism, because you think, oh no, that was my fault. I wasn't keeping my eye on the ball. In my case, I ate something I shouldn't have. In someone else's case, they lifted something that they shouldn't, whatever it is. And of course, sometimes with chronic conditions, you don't even know what caused the relapse. But if you do know, that can also then be an added thing that you're blaming yourself. You're feeling really bad about that. It's your fault that you're like this.
Yeah, and I think that's something that kind of contributes also to it being more isolating. You know, you can feel very alone with a long-term condition.
Yeah.
And even sometimes people feel that they'd rather pretend they're fine, even though they're not, than try to explain, you know, or that sort of feeling of being a burden, you know, to their family or their loved ones or whatever, and you know, and not being able to function fully and all of those things can be a real strain on relationships, can't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yes, so there is, as you say, that desire, very understandable, just not to be different, to be like everybody else. I remember somebody in a class I taught who couldn't stand for very long. She was in her 30s, so she was a relatively young woman. I remember her telling me that she was in a pub and she told somebody that she was pregnant so that she could sit down. Rather than explain that, you know, she had this condition that meant that she'd get really tired if she stood for longer than an hour. And I thought that was actually very telling, you know, and I recognised it as well, that desire just to not to be different, not to stand out. And as you say, not to have to explain every single time. And then, you said that about relationships as well. There can be that sense that you're letting people down. You know, if you have kids, that you're not able to be there for them as much as you would like or as fully as you would like. Same with spouses or with, you know, other family members or friends. You might be having to cancel on friends quite often.
Yeah.
So it takes its toll on relationships as well, which can lead then to that feeling of isolation. You're even more different from everybody else because you're not able to do the same things that they do.
For me, it's fibromyalgia. Again, it's unpredictable. I've learned a lot about myself from it. And learned about why I have it as well, which has been a massive journey of personal development. And like you say, you've had IBS since a child. I've had fibromyalgia since a child and had episodes from as young as seven. And now I understand it more. And with hindsight, it all sort of makes sense. And it's interesting what you should say there about that sense of guilt about, you know, I took my eye off the ball. It's somehow my fault that I've had a relapse. Because I would have gone through a phase of that as well, because I understood that it was to do with how I process emotions. And for me, anyway, I'm not saying that this is what fibro is for everybody, but for me, it was very much about having not had a place that was safe to deal with powerful and strong emotions, I have learned as an adult that my body and my brain and my emotions in this amazing piece of kit that it is, emotions need an expression. And so my body would store them in various places until it was ready to release them. But I remember going through a period of time before I sort of learned more about compassion for myself, whereby I would give myself a hard time because here I was flared up, and it was because I hadn't bloody well dealt with my emotions, had I, you know? And like, so I really hear you with that guilt piece, you know, because whether it's about processing emotions or eating the wrong thing or overdoing it or spending too long in the garden or whatever it might be, we then take a big stick and beat ourselves with it, and that does not help at all.
And the other thing that I find as well is a certain that adds a lot of stress is the unpredictability.
Yeah.
So that it can be very hard to plan. So I know that, you know, like most people, we have things that we need to do, things that we want to do, and I know if I can feel a flare-up coming on, I'm looking at the next few days and I'm doing a huge amount of just wondering, am I going to be able for this? Should I cancel now? Should I leave it till the last minute and see if I'm be okay? But I don't want to let people down at the last minute. Should I just carry on? Maybe I'll be okay. So I find there's a lot of that, I've got much more used to it now, so I don't stress as much about it now. But certainly at the beginning, I found that very stressful. The difficulty of knowing, of planning and knowing whether you could actually fulfill the plans that you have.
So, Fenelma, what kind of things help?
I remember somebody a while ago told me about MEDS. So MEDS stands for meditation or mindfulness, exercise, diet, sleep.
Lovely.
So I found all of those vital. The diet, very obviously, because I have a gut condition. The exercise, not just for the obvious reasons, but for being out in nature. And you know, we're all over the last year and a half, we've really, you know, seen the benefits of that more clearly, but it really helps me to relax. I've noticed that, and to feel a bit more connected, I think. And I'm lucky enough to be able to walk and be in countryside very quickly, and something about feeling connected, I'm out of my own little world in my head. I think that's what it does. It makes me just part of the wider world in a way that's really, really beneficial for me. And then sleep. And that's one thing I find, that when I have a flare up, that I'm often staying up much later than I should, because I'm reluctant to stop. I get restless. I keep going. I don't want to go to sleep, because that means even just for a short while, just being with the pain. Okay. And I should say, I don't experience very bad pain. I'm lucky like that, but I still am reluctant to be with it. So I've kind of most of the time have learned that go to bed anyway, because the following day, if I'm tired, I'm not going to make great choices. So the sleep is vital, and I am lucky enough to be able to sleep, so it doesn't affect my sleep. And then the meditation and the mindfulness, for me, that just is what it all hangs on, actually. That's become the absolute mainstay of my management of this.
Okay.
Absolute mainstay. For lots of different ways. You mentioned compassion and kindness, so that's been absolutely huge to notice when I'm blaming myself. And just to soften that, to let myself off the hook. Because I find when I'm blaming myself, it's not only that it's really unpleasant, but it adds tension to my body. And it's also more likely then that I will ignore the symptoms and keep going, because there's a part of me feels that, I don't know, I don't deserve to rest, or there's something going on there that I'm much more likely to ignore what's happening. I can also feel resentful. That's the other thing.
Mm-hmm.
Resentful of others. So, you know, if I'm kind to myself, then the people I live with also benefit.
Yes.
Because I'm not as cranky with them. Mm-hmm. I'm not taking it out on them, which is another thing we didn't mention, but that's really common too. You know, we're human. Mm-hmm. Things are tough. We often will, you know, be irritable, cranky. Mm-hmm. So the people around us suffer too. So that kindness is absolutely vital. And there are specific practices that you can do for that. And I would do regularly self-compassion practices, loving kindness. Mm-hmm. And that's not only then for compassion for yourself. And I cannot overemphasize how important that is. Mm-hmm. In just allowing your body to relax. I think there's a physiological thing when you're kind to yourself. And we all know it, when someone has been kind to us, you kind of let go, your body lets go.
Yeah.
And when it does that, it's relaxing. So it's not tensing up. Mm. You're not going into fight or flight, you know, you're relaxing. So there is a physiological as well as an emotional benefit to it.
And you used the word earlier, softening, in relation to compassion. And I absolutely love that, because it does soften you. It softens your physical body, and it softens your emotional self as well, doesn't it?
Yeah. And there's something around when you're kinder to yourself, as I mentioned, you're just more open to others too, because you're not as closed in on yourself. So the softening is a kind of softening of that wall that we often put up as a defense, you know, just to protect ourselves, but it can keep other people out. And this practice that I mentioned, the loving kindness practice, also is a practice in developing more compassion to others as well. You bring people to mind, and you just bring them to mind with kindness. And we were talking there about isolation, and having a chronic condition can feel very isolating because you feel different to others. But this is a practice that helps you to feel more connected to others. What do we share?
Yeah.
I see this as that you use your condition, rather than feeling different from others, that you use your condition as a way of connecting to others, because we know what it's like to feel pain, we know what it's like to suffer, and everybody on the planet has that experience in different ways and at different times, but nobody gets a free pass through this life. So having that sense of, okay, I actually know what it's like, so that can open me up to others rather than closing me down. So that's one practice that I have found transformative, actually.
I learned through mindfulness practice that self-awareness piece of noticing what you're doing to yourself and what your inner dialogue is. Was that when I was in pain, or when my legs weren't working properly, like there was a period of time during one particularly bad episode where I lost the spasticity in my muscles in my legs, and I actually thought I had MS, and I had all the tests, and thankfully it wasn't, but you know, my legs didn't work. And, you know, there is that tendency then to curse the muscles that aren't working. You know, God damn, these legs, they're not working. And through that practice of awareness, I started to realize, well, actually, I'm cursing myself and I'm cursing my muscles. We also, I think, generally use fighting talk around illness. People battle cancer. They fought till the very end. We hear, you know, they put up a good fight. We hear all this. It's all battle talk, and there is all this fighting. And so the practice of self-compassion helps to not only create some peace in your dialogue with yourself, but also when you start being loving and kind to, let's say, the muscles in your thighs, and sort of say, thank you for doing the best you can.
Yeah.
It actually is a game changer.
Yeah.
But it's hard to do at the same time. You have to actually shift your thinking.
Yeah.
And some of that thinking, we absorb it from our culture. It's nearly expected that we'll, you know, you talked about barreling through earlier. Yeah. And there is this kind of, that's what warriors do.
Yeah.
Like everything, there's a balance to be had. And sometimes we do have to be warriors, but be kind to ourselves as warriors.
Yes.
And love the parts of us that aren't working properly, and be gentle with them and kind. Gratitude practice is also a big feature in mindfulness, and being grateful. I used to sort of, you know, practice being grateful to the bits of my body that did work right. And then I started being grateful to the bits of my body that weren't working properly, and sort of saying, thank you for trying, and thank you for giving me the messages that you're giving me. Mm. You know, you said earlier on about ignoring symptoms.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts, Fidelma, around all that, around befriending our illness?
Yeah, that's lovely what you described there about thanking your body for doing its best.
Yeah.
Doing the best that it can do. Yeah. Yes, I think that it is, absolutely. It's a really important practice. I think sometimes people maybe need to work up to it a bit, because for sometimes, as you say, our whole instinct is to battle, to fight, to overcome, to prevail. And it's very, first of all, it's in our culture. And secondly, it is our attitude, isn't it? This is a problem, so I'm going to do my best to fix it.
Yeah.
And it takes a while to realize, actually, with a chronic condition, this is about management rather than fixing.
Mm.
And that can be a massive shift to make mentally. So, yeah, so that the compassion, I think, really helps with that kind of shift. The befriending, absolutely. Sometimes I think that it can be, as I say, a sort of gradual thing that can be just starting with just listening and being aware, okay, what's actually happening in my body right now in this moment? What's actually happening? And with mindfulness, it often, that's really where it starts, is with that. Mm. For some people, the idea of befriending that pain is just too much.
Yeah.
This thing that's ruined my life. No.
Yeah.
No, not ready for that. But it can start with, okay, well, let me just listen a bit more closely to what's actually happening. And that takes a good bit of courage, I think, as well, because a lot of the battling is a pushing away. And there's often fear in that. So I think it takes courage to stop and be still. And what actually does this feel like, this pain? Where do I sense it? Is it coming or going? Is it strong? Is it, does it change? All of that takes courage to do that. And but you can do it very gently. So there's a practice called the body scan, which a lot of people are probably familiar with, where you literally just go through mentally, just bring your attention to each part of your body, so that you're not going straight for the pain, but you're taking in your whole body. And it's almost like a training to say, okay, what's here?
And I know that there's a magpie in your back garden who's having a good old chat, because there's a cat that just walked across your garden. So just for our listeners, that background noise is actually a magpie. But our conversation is going so nicely, I didn't want to interrupt it. So just to be mindful of the magpie.
You talked about listening to the body's messages. And I think that's what that helps to do, is just being quiet and listening. And with practice, then, those sensations become more familiar and less scary. Everything that's familiar is usually less scary. People we don't know might be a bit wary of them. When you get to know them, it's fine. And I think it's similar here. So the more familiar you become with the sensations, then it's easier to say, okay, well, actually, this isn't so bad. Also, yeah, this is a part of me. This isn't something that's separate, that's intruding on my life. This is a part of me. So how can I be a bit more open? We'll often use the word acceptance, but it's also one that can raise hackles a bit, because it sounds like resignation or giving up. something like making room for or allowing to be there. It's really pretty much the same thing.
I like the word willingness when it comes to acceptance.
Mm.
Acceptance can sometimes feel a little bit like you're lying down under it and going, oh, here you go, just drive over me, you know.
Yeah.
But a willingness to be curious about things, or a willingness to, you know, be open to what message that part of your body might have for you, or what does that sensation or pain hold for you.
There's something about, isn't it? I think we keep coming back to that openness. Because when we're not willing, or when we're not befriending, or when we're battling, it's closed. So you can't see, but I got my fist closed here to demonstrate that. And then that kind of opening means that there's just, more able to let things be, in a way, to not to be trying to push it away all the time, which is usually what we do. But that pushing away adds tension, can add more stress. We're catastrophizing, imagining all the worst things that could possibly happen. That's the brain is trying to push away. Whereas the softening, the opening, I'm opening my fist here, just allows it to be there without that sense of having to control it all the time, having to push it away. And it's very counterintuitive, but it makes an enormous difference as to how we relate to it. And I think that's the key with mindfulness, is that it may or may not have an impact on the actual physical sensations, but it has a huge impact on how we relate to those symptoms and to those sensations.
We're also in the territory here of non-judgment and non-agenda. Just, you know, that acceptance, that willingness, that curiosity is about not judging it as good or bad or agony or bliss, but that it is what it is, sort of thing. One of the words that kind of came into my head was resistance, you know, that we resist. And again, it is that sort of sense of, if you don't resist it, you know, that you will actually go under it, or that it will somehow take you over. And yet that resistance tightens us, it brings that tension, doesn't it, into the body and into the flow of emotions and so on. And that somewhere in the softening, we have to let go of that resisting, which can be scary, can't it? You talked about courage earlier, about the courage to sit with what's happening actually in our bodies.
And I think there's a few things that help there. So one is that when you are being more open and curious, befriending, even just aware, that it's always just what's there in the moment. So it's not like you have to be aware forever, 24/7, of the awfulness. It's not that. It's just this moment. What am I sensing just right now in this moment? And the other thing is that, and you really learn this in a very visceral way through practicing mindfulness, is how things are changing all the time. So the pain can feel like one big block of horribleness. But actually, when you're paying attention moment by moment, you can say, oh, actually, this does shift a little bit. You know, there's movements here. It varies in intensity. It actually goes sometimes. There's gaps. So, so those two things, it's always just in the moment. And the moment is always changing. And the other thing with mindfulness is that it is a kind of training, and this is where the meditation comes in. The meditation really is your training, and that can be for as little as 5 minutes. It doesn't have to be a huge, big, long session. You can if you want, but even just 5-10 minutes of meditation on a reasonably regular basis strengthens your mental ability to be able to do what we're talking about. You know, I don't know if you've found that you just get better at it as you go on.
We live in a world where time features big for us, doesn't it? And we break time down into all kinds of increments. And, you know, we can break it down into nanoseconds now, you know. But the moment is different because it's not an increment in time. And it's fluid and it moves and it changes. And it's just being present to whatever is right here and now. And right here and now is this constantly moving and evolving and changing thing. People can feel a little overwhelmed with sitting with pain. And that pain could be physical pain or emotional pain or a bit of both.
Yeah.
Because it can become more intense when you attend to it.
Yeah.
And so there's something in there around trusting that process of knowing that it will ebb, or it may get more intense before it ebbs away because you paid attention, but one way or another it is going to change. Learning to sit with it for short periods, even nanoseconds maybe to start with, and building on that.
And you also always have choice.
So
that if it does become too much, you always have the choice to bring your attention elsewhere. I'm teaching this. We talk about primary and secondary suffering and distinguishing between those. And that's really helpful. So primary suffering is the physical, the difficult physical sensations in the moment. And then the secondary suffering are the things that we add to it. And that's talked about the resistance. So the frustration, the anger, the guilt, the anxiety, the fear, that's all the secondary suffering. So there are things that we add to it that actually add to our suffering. We're not consciously doing that, but that's in effect what we are doing. And so what we're talking about here, that ability to just be able to identify the sensations in the body, not to immediately go into battling them, gives you that ability to distinguish. Okay, so this is what's here. This is the pain or difficulty that's here right now in this moment. Can't really do much about that right now. But this other stuff, all of this planning or analyzing or, you know, resentful thinking, actually, I can let that go. I can let that go. And I can let it go by coming back to my body, by bringing my attention back to my body. So it gives us that choice. And it's one of the things we've been talking about, training. It's a training in choosing where to place your attention, rather than your attention just being pulled away to, you know, whatever thoughts you're having or whatever sounds you're hearing. So that can be hugely helpful, just to say, okay, this is the primary suffering here. This is what I can be kind to. It helps you to actually see more clearly what you need.
Okay.
Because it might be, oh, I just actually just need to rest. I just need to have a rest. Or I'm feeling quite low about this. I need to ring a friend and just have a chat. Or a walk. That's what I need. Or I need to take a painkiller. Or maybe I don't need to take a painkiller. Maybe you're used to just taking them without thinking as soon as you feel any pain. But if you're sitting with it, you're like, actually, you know, this isn't so bad, actually. I can get on with things without having to take a painkiller. So it does give a lot more choice as to how you respond. Because we've talked a lot about sitting with, and that's part of the practice. But in a way, what that leads to then is choice.
Yeah.
That's what it leads to. So it's not a passive thing about just kind of lying back and just, you know, sitting with it for hours on end. It's a training, a mental training, where you can then, once you've sat with it for a minute or 10 minutes or however much you choose, you then have much greater ability to choose how best to respond to it.
I think that's really powerful. We're empowered through choice, aren't we? So if we can choose, you know, especially around that secondary suffering, we can't necessarily choose, you know, not to have the pain in our back or whatever it might be. But if we can choose then not to let our mind go into that secondary place of why is this happening to me?
Yeah.
Or it could be that worrying about, oh God, it's going to get worse and now I'm not going to get any sleep and then tomorrow I'm going to be useless and I won't be able to, you know, and all of that projecting and that we do. So that's really interesting. I think really useful too, Fidelma. Thank you for that.
Mm-hmm.
The breath.
I knew we were going to come to that. I was just thinking of
yeah. yeah. Breath awareness is such a powerful tool. And it's such a useful anchor for this moment we're talking about, you know, and keeping us there in the moment. I mean, you can use it in so many ways, you know, to release tension, let's say, or to bring in light to your body, or to imagine that it's dissolving a knot in your shoulder, or, you know, you can use it in so many ways. And just being present to it as well, just feeling it in your body, feeling the sensations and so on. So what are your experiences around using the breath?
Yeah, well, personally, it's another game changer is being aware of the breathing. And I remember when I first started to meditate, I noticed that my breathing was all over the place. And having since then gone on to teach meditation, it happens to a lot of people at the beginning. And I've since come to think that it's we're so used to controlling our breath without realizing it, holding the breath or the very shallow breathing, but when you come to bring attention to it, it feels really odd, you know, staying with it in a very gentle way regardless of whether your breathing is shallow or however it is, over time helps the breathing to become deeper, helps your breathing to become more even. And so that's the practice, in a way. The meditation practice is just noticing your breathing. We talked about sitting with, so it's kind of like just noticing your breathing. But then that gives you the ability, as you say, to really tap into it as a resource. Just breathing out stimulates your parasympathetic nervous system, which is your system at rest, which is ideally how we should be most of the time, unless there's a genuine threat. But unfortunately, many of us, you know, because we think we're under some kind of threat, we're used to being in that state, particularly people with chronic condition, actually. So because you're physiologically, your body reacts as if there's some, if there's pain, then that's a threat.
Yeah.
So as you say, your breathing gets shallower, because you're ready to fight or flee from that.
Yeah, and interesting as you're saying that, I'm thinking that those secondary sufferings, you know, are very often what will bring on that fight or flight, aren't they? They're the threat. It's the what ifs.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yes, because as your mind imagines all the things that might happen, your body reacts as if they are actually happening. So, yeah, as you said, when we're generally relaxed, our breathing is deep. When we're not relaxed, our breathing is shallow. But you can choose then to deliberately slow down your breathing, to deliberately breathe out more slowly, to bring about a calmer state. And it's so simple. You don't have to bring anything with you. You don't have to buy anything. You don't have to go to lessons. It's there, right there in the moment. And it also means that when you're aware of your breathing, you're in the present moment. So we talk a lot in mindfulness about being in the present moment. And if you've never practiced it before, it sounds a bit vague, you know, what does it mean? But you can only be aware of the breath that you're breathing right now. You can't be aware of the breath that you breathed a few minutes ago or the breath that you're going to breathe in a few minutes. You can only be aware of this minute now or this moment now. And your breath helps you to connect to this moment. So you're not worrying about the future. You're not mulling over the past. You're just here now. So it's an extraordinary resource. And we talked about kindness as well. You can also use your breathing as a way of bringing kindness and compassion to yourself as well, either through words or images or a felt sense of warmth, that the breath can feel very soothing as well. There's also movement practices as well. And so, you know, they're not accessible to everybody depending on, you know, your condition. But mindful movement can be really lovely to do, even if your mobility is affected. Practices that you can do that develop awareness of your body. Something about really slowing down and noticing your body as it moves. And then walking meditation or mindful walking can be really lovely to do, particularly in nature, if you can and if that's accessible. So that's really where you just walk slowly and you're aware of your body as it's moving, but you're also aware of your surroundings. You can be aware of what you're seeing, what you're hearing, maybe smelling the sun or the breeze on your skin, or sounds from around, the wind or people talking that you can hear, whatever it is. There are some practices, like it's called the three-step breathing space, where you stop and you become aware of your body and your breath and how you're feeling. So there are much smaller things that you can do throughout the day. Eating is another one. You can eat mindfully, bringing attention to the taste of the food, the sensations of your chewing, what you feel in your stomach as you eat, and so on.
Yeah, that's lovely. Thank you for that.
Pleasure.
And hopefully our listeners will benefit as well from these lovely practices that we've been talking about. Thank you, Fidelma. I really enjoyed talking with you. We've reached the end of this episode. The practices mentioned, including the body scan, breath awareness, self-compassion, loving kindness, etc., are all available in the guided practices section on our website, www.mentalhealthireland.ie/mindfulness. There are a variety of options to choose from, some short and some longer in duration. Feel free to experiment with them and find the ones that resonate with you. Most of all, I hope this episode will serve to support you in navigating your life in a mindful way.